Today is Thursday, September 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States charged five Chinese nationals with hacking.
These intrusions allowed hackers to steal source code, customer account data, and personally identifiable information.
Plus, the World Health Organization issues a warning on the coronavirus.
One of these worrying trends that I mentioned are the hospitalizations among younger people between 15 years old and 44 years old.
And World Athletics chief Lamine Diak was sentenced to 4 years in prison on charges of corruption. We'll have these stories and more next. The Geneva-based World Trade Organization says the Trump administration tariffs on Chinese goods totaling more than $200 billion are illegal under the rules of the global trade body. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The decision marks the first time the WTO has ruled against a series of tariffs that President Donald Trump has imposed on a number of countries, allies and rivals alike. In its decision, the trade body ruled against the administration's argument that China has engaged in practices harmful to American interests on issues including intellectual property theft, technology transfer and innovation. The ruling, in theory, would allow China to impose retaliatory tariffs on billions worth of U.S. goods if the process is completed. But the U.S. government can appeal the decision. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
During a press conference held at the White House on Wednesday, U.S. President Donald Trump responded to the ruling.
The WTO, as far as I'm concerned, was created to suck money and jobs out of the United States to the benefit of China and other countries. That's what my opinion is, whether it was created or it just turned out to be that way. But the World Trade Organization has been not good for the United States. It's been good for everybody else, but it's not been good. It was a method, in my opinion, of taking advantage of the United States. So we're looking into what happened, and we'll get back to you.
The U.S. Justice Department charged five Chinese citizens with hacks targeting more than 100 companies and institutions in the United States and elsewhere, including social media and video game companies, as well as universities and telecommunications providers. Jim Dawson, special agent in charge of the FBI Criminal and Cyber Division in Washington, explained the cyber intrusions.
These intrusions allowed hackers to steal source code, customer account data, and personally identifiable information. Using their access, the hackers not only compromised an individual company, but also used their access to compromise a company's customers, extending the effects of their crimes.
Officials said that the five defendants remain fugitives, but prosecutors say that two Malaysian businessmen accused of conspiring with the alleged hackers to profit off the attacks on video game companies were arrested in that country this week and face extradition proceedings. Jeffrey Rosen, the deputy attorney general, said ideally he would like to be thanking Chinese officials for their assistance in capturing the fugitives.
Unfortunately, the record of recent years tells us that the Chinese Communist Party has a demonstrated history of choosing a different path, that of making China safe for their own cyber criminals, as long as they help with its goals of stealing intellectual property and stifling freedom.
The indictments announced Wednesday are part of a larger and broader effort by the Trump administration to call out cybercrimes by China. In July, prosecutors accused hackers of working with the Chinese government to target firms developing vaccines for the coronavirus and stealing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of intellectual property and trade secrets from companies across the world. Much has been written about the 102 Europeans who crossed the Atlantic Ocean aboard the Mayflower in 1620. Much less has been written about the Wampanoag Native American community the Europeans met on the other side. After four centuries, a new exhibition in the place where the ship set sail aims to highlight the largely ignored history of the Wampanoag people. Martha Vanderwolf has that story.
In the year 1620, the Mayflower left the port of Plymouth in southern England and arrived 10 weeks later in what is now the U.S. state of Massachusetts. The story of the religious separatist and colonist has been well documented over the centuries, unlike the experiences of the Wampanoag Native American community that was already living there. An exhibit in Plymouth marking the 400-year anniversary of the Mayflower voyage is putting the history of the Wampanoag front and center. Stephen Peters, a citizen of the Wampanoag tribe who's involved in curating the exhibit in Britain, says the arrival of the Mayflower has historically been told from a European point of view.
We think that once everyone has a chance to listen to all perspectives and absorb the perspective of both the Europeans and the Native Americans, they can then come to an understanding of what this history was and what those impacts were on the Native communities that unfortunately were colonized.
The arrival of the Mayflower is commonly associated with the American tradition of Thanksgiving celebrations, the first of which was, according to history, in 1621 when Europeans and Native Americans joined in celebration. But critics say the traditional Thanksgiving narrative overlooks how the arrival of settlers ultimately meant loss of life, culture, and lives for many Native Americans over the centuries that followed. Peter says working on projects having to do with the history of his ancestors is part of a difficult journey.
Often the history and the stories that we're retelling are tragic, and there's a lot of death and sickness, and so it's emotional for us.
British curator Joe Loosemore of the Mayflower 400 Legacy and Legend Exhibition hopes to fill knowledge gaps. There is a wealth of information about the maritime journey, the religious perspective, and the separatist movement. But she says that for most English people, the story only begins in 1620.
And what the Wampanoag people have enabled us to see is that, you know, the Mayflower certainly wasn't the first ship to cross the Atlantic with traders or settlers or colonists. And also the story most definitely does not begin in 1620. You know, for the Wampanoag, you're talking a 12,000-year civilization and society, a history and a culture.
An estimated 30 million Americans can trace an ancestral connection to the Mayflower. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
The World Health Organization warned on Wednesday that COVID-19, the illness caused by the novel coronavirus, is spreading at a worrying pace in some parts of the Northern Hemisphere, a few months away from the winter influenza season.
Now, there's numbers of reasons for that. One is we're in a much better position to detect cases. So countries have worked very hard to set up active case finding, improve their testing capacity, and so we have a better ability to look for cases.
WHO technical lead for COVID-19, Maria Van Kerkhove, said they are seeing an increase in hospitalizations in intensive care units in several places, including Spain, France, Montenegro, Ukraine, and some states of the United States.
One of these worrying trends that I mentioned are the hospitalizations among younger people between 15 years old and 44 years old. We're seeing a slight increase in hospitalizations in some countries at that age group. That is incredibly worrying. And so we do need to prevent those infections.
Mike Ryan, the WHO Emergencies Program Director, recommended that older individuals and those with underlying health conditions get vaccinated against the seasonal flu. Because not only can that disease be deadly, the pandemic is ongoing.
This is a virus for which we have a vaccine. And most countries have very, very positive policies towards free vaccination and subsidized vaccination for influenza. So please, if it's available, get your flu vaccine.
There are currently nearly 30 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 around the globe, with India seeing a rapid rise in the number of cases. The U.S. has 6.6 million cases. India has just over 5 million. And Brazil has more than 4.3 million. Those are according to statistics maintained by Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. The world is also approaching 1 million deaths attributed to the novel coronavirus, and more than 20 million people have recovered from it. VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. Fires burning in California are the largest on record. In Washington state, a larger area burned in 5 days than have previously burned any year prior to that on record, save one. And in Oregon, 1/10 of the state's population was under fire evacuation warnings or orders since last week. Scientists say climate change is making fires worse in the American West. And VOA's Steve Barragona has that story.
As record-breaking fires burn across the western United States, President Donald Trump remains skeptical that climate change is a factor. Here he is Monday at a meeting with California officials.
It'll start getting cooler. You just watch.
I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
Yet science has been sounding the alarm about climate change for a long time, says University of California Merced wildfire expert Leroy Westerling.
We've been doing modeling and simulation for years now that indicates that these really severe, widespread fire seasons are coming. And we're seeing that emerge in real time.
Wildfires need dry plants to burn, and climate change is increasing the supply, he says. Studies show the West has warmed over the last century, and warmer air dries things faster. That means even a normal year would be drier. But these have not been normal years, he says.
We had a drought for 5 years earlier in the 21st century here that was unprecedented in probably the last 1,000 to 1,200 years at least.
And warmer weather is melting the West's water reserves in the mountains. The region relies on winter snow accumulation to provide long-lasting water supplies, says wildfire expert Jessica Holofsky with the U.S. Forest Service.
We're seeing more precipitation falling as rain rather than snow. The snowpack isn't lasting as long with the higher temperatures, so it's running off earlier in the season,
leaving less water when the dry summer months arrive. And warmer, drier conditions have helped tree-killing beetles multiply. All this has left roughly 150 million dead, flammable trees standing in California's forests alone. But Holofsky says humans share the blame for the fires. Smaller fires used to happen naturally, which thinned out the forests.
We have suppressed fire very effectively since World War II. That means there are more fuels now than there used to be. And so when fires do occur, there's more fuel to burn and they're more severe.
Plus, more people are living in areas that are prone to burn. So when fires do break out, they're more destructive and more costly. Conditions will get worse as the planet continues to warm, Holofsky says.
There's going to be more fire. You know, a kind of ballpark is maybe 2 to 3 times the annual area burned in the future.
Scientists say this year's record-breaking fire season is just a taste of what's to come. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
And coming up later in today's program,
We made a decision really early on because we weren't sure what travel restrictions were going to be like to sort of move away from that live filmmaker introduction and Q&A experience. We love it, but I think this model all filmmakers will still be doing intros and Q&As, but they'll be doing those virtually.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
When stars like our sun die, they expand into a red giant as it burns through what's left of its fuel supply. As the star gets bigger and bigger, it's expected that any solar system object in its path, including planets, will be engulfed and incinerated. What remains of the star afterwards is a small, hot, and dense cinder-like core called a white dwarf. A team of astronomers using space and ground-based telescopes say they found what might be the first undamaged planet to closely orbit a white dwarf. The object, identified as WD-1856b, is Jupiter-sized, is about 7 times bigger than the white dwarf, and orbits what remains of its star once every 34 hours. The planet-like object and the white dwarf are located about 80 light-years away in the constellation Draco. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. United Nations investigators report the government of Venezuela, state agents, and affiliated groups are responsible for widespread and systemic violations against political dissidents, human rights activists, and other perceived opponents, and that many of these violations amount to crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein reports the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Venezuela has issued a 411-page report documenting thousands of cases of alleged human rights violations committed since 2014.
UN investigators report the government of Venezuela, state agents, and affiliated groups are responsible for widespread and systematic violations against political dissidents, human rights activists, and other perceived opponents, and that many of these violations amount to crimes against humanity. The independent international fact-finding mission on Venezuela has issued a 411-page report documenting thousands of cases of alleged human rights violations committed since 2014. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Over the past month, the mission investigated and documented extrajudicial executions and forced disappearances, arbitrary detentions, and torture, including sexual and gender-based violence. The government of Venezuela has refused the mission entry into the country, so investigators have interviewed witnesses and victims from afar. On the basis of the evidence it has collected, the mission says it believes serious human rights violations and international crimes have taken place in Venezuela in the context of public protests, targeted political repression, and security operations. The chair of the mission, Mata Valinas, says violations have been committed directly by security forces and intelligence agencies.
We have reasonable grounds to believe that high-level authorities within these entities, as well as political authorities who exercise power and oversight over them, including the president and the ministers of interior and of defense, were aware of these crimes and either ordered or otherwise contributed to them.
The mission investigated 16 cases of police, military, or joint operations resulting in 53 extrajudicial executions. Valinda says the mission also reviewed more than 2,500 incidents involving more than 5,000 killings by security forces.
The mission's investigations revealed, however, that these victims were killed once they were already under the control of the armed security officials, with fatal shots to vital areas, and that these crimes were covered up by state officials who at times planted weapons near victims' bodies to claim that they were killed while resisting authority or as a result of confrontations.
The mission says the crimes are being committed to quash political opposition, and it is state policy to target those who oppose the government. The investigators say the majority of unlawful killings are never prosecuted. They are calling for the perpetrators to be brought to justice. They also are urging Venezuelan authorities to carry out independent and transparent investigations into violations and crimes. Failing that, they say those responsible for violations should be brought before the International Criminal Court. The government of President Nicolas Maduro has rebuffed the mission. Valina says the mission has offered to send the report to the government before publication, but received no response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Belarusian opposition leader and human rights advocate Svetlana Tushkunskaya has expressed regret that President Alexander Lukashenko met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, as a leading human rights organization accused Belarusian security forces of unlawfully arresting thousands of people and torturing hundreds of others. Thousands have taken part in 6 weeks of protests that were triggered by a brutal government crackdown shortly after the disputed August 9th election of Lukashenko, which has resulted in the detention of nearly 7,000 people, the deaths of at least 3 people, and hundreds of others being injured. Putin recognizes Lukashenko as a legitimate leader of Belarus, despite the ongoing mass protests. Earlier this week, Human Rights Watch accused Belarusian security forces of detaining and torturing people in the days after Lukashenko's re-election. The head of Libya's UN-supported government says he wants to hand over power to a new administration in October amid talks on ending the country's conflict. Fayez Sarraj made the announcement in a televised speech Wednesday night from the capital of Tripoli. Libya's factions are expected to convene soon for peace talks. They agreed earlier this month to hold elections within 18 months and appoint a new government, Libya was plunged into chaos when a NATO-backed uprising in 2011 toppled the government of Muammar Gaddafi, who was later killed. The country has since split between rival East and West-based administrations, each backed by armed groups and foreign governments. A Paris court has sentenced former World Athletics chief Lamine Diak to 4 years in prison on charges of corruption, money laundering, and abuse of confidence. The charges stem from a Russian doping scandal and for accepting Russian money to finance the 2012 election campaign of Senegalese president Macky Sall. Lisa Bryant reports.
The judgment has 87-year-old Senegalese Lamine Diak, ex-World Athletics or IAAF chief, serving 2 years in jail with an additional two-year suspended sentence. The court also fined him nearly $600,000, the maximum under French law.
Cela est profondément injuste. Nous trouvons que
Diak's lawyers say they will appeal what they describe as a profoundly unfair verdict. Either way, Diak appears unlikely to go to jail. The presiding judge predicted a conditional release given his age. Diak's Dakar-based son, Papa Massata Diak, got a tougher sentence in absentia, 5 years in prison, along with a nearly $1.2 million fine. The younger Diak is accused of overseeing a vast network of corruption as a former IAAF marketing advisor. Papa Massata Diak refused to attend the Paris trial. Speaking to reporters in Dakar earlier this week, he insisted he was innocent. In addition, an investigation against him is underway in Senegal. During the Paris trial, the senior Diak also denied corruption. He admitted to slowing the handling of Russian doping allegations, but said it was to snag lucrative Russian sponsorship deals that would help shore up the organization's finances. Furthermore, the senior Diak denied charges of taking Russian funds to finance the successful 2012 election campaign of Senegalese president Macky Sall. Trial observers say Diak's testimony was often confusing. One of Diak's lawyers urged leniency, saying it was important he die in dignity in his native land. Prosecutors argued Diak's behavior deeply tarnished the IAAF. A once powerful figure in the sports world, Diak headed the IAAF for 16 years before stepping down in 2015. Olympic gold medalist Sebastian Coe took over as head of the organization, which has been renamed World Athletics. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Nigeria's Supreme Court in late August upheld the right of female children to inherit property from their fathers, a ruling that has shaken traditional male-only inheritance in ethnic groups like the Igbo. While rights activists celebrate the ruling as an advance for equality between the sexes, some critics say the Supreme Court ruling attacks traditions and customs. Timothy Obiju has the details.
Kiruka Ani is from a polygamous family in southeastern Nigeria. Her mother is the second of three wives, and her only brother and heir to family property died early this year. In March, she and her mother were excluded from her family's assets during a sharing process that followed Igbo customs forbidding women from family inheritance. Rolling up bowls of locust bean for the market, Annie says she's trying to pick up the pieces of her life.
I believe that we all humans, everything that they give to male ones, they should give also to the female ones. Nobody, as in, we are equal. But I don't know their own mentality. Maybe the female are not, they are not, I don't understand.
The age-long practice that disinherits women is based on the idea that a female child will someday get married and leave her home to live with her new family. Over the years, many women like Annie have been denied money and property as a result. But late last month, Nigeria's Supreme Court, in a landmark judgment, annulled the tradition and called it discriminatory and contradictory to the nation's constitution. Nigerian gender equality advocate Solomon Buchi celebrated the decision.
Constantly, we culture on the scale of objectivity,
on the scale of fairness, on the scale of justice, on the scale of equality and equity? Is it fair to people? Is it just to people? Is it equitable? Is it compassionate? We don't want to call it our culture, or we are not going to pride in a culture that dehumanizes.
Others object. Abuja residents Iluchuku and Chikwadi believe the traditional way of doing things has served people well.
Properties should be shared among men, because that has been something our forefathers has been doing for so long, and it has been working. It has been working like that, and I don't think our women are complaining.
It's left for the boy child now to consider the girls and give them some.
Even so, the chairman of the Abuja Council of Igbo Traditional Rulers, Ezudo Uche Egenti, wants other monarchs to support the Supreme Court judgment.
The Supreme Court has spoken. It is proper for you and I to go by the laws of the land. And I wonder why it's just on Igbo land. You understand? Which means the North, the South, they are not practicing the same thing we are practicing.
While some predict implementing and enforcing the court's ruling will be difficult, gender equality advocates say they will be observing the progress. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
This year's London Film Festival will not have its usual galas and red carpet openings because of the coronavirus pandemic. However, as VOA's David Byrd reports, more people will have access to the films because it's going virtual.
Fans who want to attend this year's London Film Festival won't have to buy a new gown or rent a black tie tuxedo. They won't have to fight through armies of photographers or have a special pass to see panel discussions with top stars and directors. They can do it from home. This year's event has gone virtual because of the coronavirus pandemic. Fans who normally would have to go to London can now see films online or in one of several cinemas in other cities, including Sheffield, Brighton, Belfast, Manchester, and Glasgow. British Film Institute Director of Festivals Tricia Tuttle told the Associated Press organizers didn't want to take the risks with socially distanced premieres that were taken at the Venice Film Festival.
We made a decision really early on because we weren't sure what travel restrictions were going to be like to sort of move away from that live filmmaker introduction and Q&A experience. We love it. But I think this model all filmmakers will still be doing intros and Q&As, but they'll be doing those virtually.
This year's festival opens with director Steve McQueen's Mangrove, starring Letitia Wright and Sean Parks, about a highly publicized trial of a group of black activists who clashed with London police in the 1970s. Oscar winner Frances McDormand's Nomadland, fresh from winning the Golden Lion in Venice, will also be featured. Harry McQueen's love story Supernova, starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci, is part of London's lineup. McQueen told the AP going virtual gives filmmakers and audiences the best of both worlds.
So I think whether people see the film in their kitchen or their bedroom or their living room or in their local cinema, the important thing is that they have the access to do that. And it's really important to be doing that right now, especially in the current unfortunate COVID situation. It's super exciting.
The festival will close with Francis Lee's Ammonite, starring Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan, and based on the life and love of paleontologist Mary Anning, who falls in love with Ronan's Charlotte Murchison in 1840s England. Lee, who also directed 2017's God's Own Country, told the AP that taking the festival virtual offers fans the opportunity to see films they might never see otherwise.
I think that, as somebody who doesn't live in London and doesn't, have access to lots and lots of independent cinemas, getting to see new work and getting to see work that sometimes doesn't make it into local cinemas, regional cinemas, I think it's a really great opportunity.
The London Film Festival runs from October 7th to the 18th. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.